Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. HR Florida State Council. Advocating for the workplace on behalf of 15,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council. A resource for lawmakers, media, and human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. And from the United Faculty of Florida, representing over 20,000 faculty, staff professionals, and graduate assistants at 13 universities and 14 colleges. Advocates for quality higher education for all Floridians. Online at myuff.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
A weekend wildfire strikes northwest Florida, and state officials like Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried say things will get worse unless the feds send help fast.
Other parts of our country have seen disaster packages within weeks after disaster, and now, almost 6 months later, we are still waiting.
Also tonight, Governor Ron DeSantis taps a new leader for the Department of Health.
This is a very, very accomplished guy, and it's done a lot for our state.
We'll also check on the status of the Schools of Hope program that was supposed to provide an option for kids whose public schools are falling short, and we'll learn why some folks in Florida are not thrilled about upcoming changes to the U.S. Census. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's the start of week five in the nine-week Florida legislative session, and this is Capitol Report. For Bay County in northwest Florida, the week got off to not such a great start over the weekend. As Lynn Hatter reports, a wildfire accelerated by thousands of tons of trees downed by Hurricane Michael back in October scorched more than 600 acres, and far worse may be on the way.
The irony, says Bay County Incident Commander Bryce Thomas, is that most of the debris on the ground will be gotten rid of through burning.
But it's got to be burned correctly by professionals, air curtain burners, things of that nature. People need to be so careful right now.
Over the weekend, the Allentown fire broke out, scorching more than 650 acres of land in Bay County. It's 50% contained. The cause of the fire is still under investigation, but State Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried says what would have been a small fire grew quickly because of both weather conditions and the amount of debris, or what officials call fuel, on the ground.
And under normal conditions, it would have been a few hours and only a few acres. But because the fact of all the timber on the ground, and because the weather conditions is what escalated it to be the 600 plus, is because of all the fuel on the ground. And more importantly, an inability to get there because we still have road access issues because of all the downed timber. It's harder for the Forest Services and the fire to get into that area and to actually create a perimeter zone, which is, again, more dangerous for actually fighting the fire. And a lot of it's going to have to go to the air.
For months, there have been warnings about the increased risk of wildfire following the hurricane. The October 10th storm damaged nearly 3 million acres of land, according to the Florida Forest Service. Most of what the agency deemed as catastrophic damage occurred in Bay, Calhoun, and Gulf counties. Cleaning up all of those trees has been slow going, despite multiple agencies stepping in to assist. It's simply too much land to cover, and that's created a giant 3 million acre fire hazard. And that's about the size of Delaware and Rhode Island combined.
Our department has asked for $39 million from our state lawmakers for debris removal, reforestation, fire equipment, and wildfire mitigation for the communities affected by Hurricane Michael. We've also asked Congress to do their jobs and pass disaster relief now. Other parts of our country have seen disaster packages within weeks after disaster, and now, almost 6 months later, we are still waiting. This is absolutely unacceptable.
There have been 61 wildfires in the Panhandle area hit by Hurricane Michael since the storm. Most have been small and confined to a dozen acres or less. Another 11, including the current one, are presently active. State Forester Jim Carles says if the state can't get the trees off the ground, worse could be on the way.
This is just the beginning with the fuels on the ground, with the inability to access those areas, with many times 100 tons per acre on the ground out there that is flammable and ready to go. It's going to take an effort. It's going to take a great cooperative effort, and it's going to take federal, state, and local working together to make sure we don't have another catastrophe in the Panhandle.
Carles says conditions were dry, but not that dry. In fact, he says the ground was wet. He and others are concerned about what happens when the state enters the dry season, which starts now and goes into late summer. I'm Lynn Hatter.
Governor Ron DeSantis is tapping a doctor from the University of Florida to lead the State Department of Health. Sean Mulcahy reports DeSantis is looking to continue the fight against opioid addiction.
Scott Rivkees is the governor's pick for Florida's Surgeon General. In that role, he'll also oversee the Department of Health. Rivkees is currently in charge of the University of Florida's Pediatrics Department, housed at UF's Shands Children's Hospital.
This is a very, very accomplished guy, and has done a lot for our state at the University of Florida. And I think when you're looking at particularly these public health problems, like opioids, and I'll be doing another announcement on that shortly, he's the type of guy that I think can make a real difference.
DeSantis made the announcement in Sanford on Monday. Rivkees says there are a number of healthcare problems facing the state. He highlighted staffing shortages in medical fields and the need for expanded access to care in rural areas. The News Service of Florida reports DeSantis has had trouble filling the post with someone who shares his stance on medical marijuana. Earlier this year, the governor called on the legislature to pass a bill allowing a smokable version. Rivkees notably addressed this in his acceptance.
Medical marijuana also has proven benefit in several conditions. These include cancer pain, epilepsy. It was legalized in our state in January 2017. Recently, smokable medical marijuana was also signed into law by Governor DeSantis. We need to be sure that these legislative initiatives are implemented promptly and properly.
DeSantis also announced he's signing an executive order that will recreate the Office of Drug Control within the Executive Office of the Governor. Then-Governor Rick Scott shuttered the office in 2011. Attorney General Ashley Moody will lead an opioid task force to work with the office.
Substance abuse is a serious public health and safety concern, and the opioid epidemic has devastated families and communities throughout our state.
DeSantis says the Office of Drug Control will act as a liaison of sorts between the federal and local governments. Meanwhile, Moody's task force will develop best practices for health and law enforcement agencies, including education and even legal repercussions. The Attorney General is also leading Florida's efforts in a multi-state legal battle against pharmaceutical companies. The suit charges drug makers with fanning the opioid epidemic by marketing the narcotics. Oklahoma recently settled for $250 million, though DeSantis calls that move, quote, chump change. I'm Sean Mulcahy.
Still to come on Capitol Report, in 2017, the legislature gave incentives to charter schools to open and serve students from low-performing traditional schools. Now they are expanding where these schools can open up.
We should be excited to have these schools in our state. And what this legislation does is it gives them an opportunity to understand where their services could best be utilized.
And state lawmakers consider at least one way to help colleges whose enrollments took a dive in the wake of Hurricane Michael lure more students to their institutions.
It's affording the opportunity for those students that are from out of state to come into Florida and to help sustain the enrollment of these particular areas.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
In 2017, the legislature decided to give greater incentives to charter schools to serve students in low-performing traditional school areas. Today, an attempt to expand where the Schools of Hope could open up was approved in the House. Blaise Ganey has that story.
2 years ago, the legislature created a Schools of Hope designation, opening more money and greater operating leeway to charter schools that open near failing traditional ones. The reason was because year after year, more than 100 schools throughout the state were persistently low-performing schools, meaning for three consecutive years, they earned grades lower than a C. The first charter school company to receive the designation operates a school in Jefferson County, where the last time the district earned a C grade was in 2011. In 2018, Jefferson Somerset Academy improved the district's grade to a C for the first time in nearly a decade. Miami-based Somerset Academy and Texas-based Idea Schools are the only two approved Schools of Hope operators in the state. Now, Miami Republican Representative Vance Lupus wants to see more School of Hope operators open up.
We should be excited to have these schools in our state. And what this legislation does is it gives them an opportunity to understand where their services could best be utilized. But more importantly, it gives them a runway to be very deliberate and intentional about where they plan to school.
The legislation changes the definition of persistently low-performing schools to include schools that have earned three grades lower than a C in the last 5 years. It also allows such schools in state and federally designated opportunity zones, places targeted for more economic development. Naples Republican Representative Byron Donald says this will help catch schools that fluctuate between low-performing and meeting standards.
To a school district's credit, they will intensify their focus on a previously low-performing school to try to get the grade up. But for some reason, I don't want to throw stones or place blame, but there are times where that school will slip back into a D or an F status. And, you know, that appears to get them out of differentiated accountability for a period of time. So really expanding that definition so we make sure that we are actually focusing in on the schools that are having issues is incredibly important.
But Karen Mazzola with the Florida Parent Teacher Association says they don't like the idea of expanding charter schools into an area that may not need them.
It expands low economically struggling areas, whether or not they are a low performing school.
Mazzola says the PTA board does like the part of the bill that makes sure charter school teachers are background checked. The bill also removes the requirement for an independent evaluation of a public school that has 10 or more students receiving a Hope Scholarship. The Hope Scholarship program was established for parents whose child has reported an incident of harassment, hazing, bullying, or more.
What the department has found is that there was almost a perverse incentive not to disclose issues of bullying because once we reached 10 reports, an independent audit was called. So that would remove this requirement.
The bill has passed its first committee today and is now headed to the House Education Committee. Bills that address some of the changes are moving along in the Senate. I'm Blaise Ganey.
A year out from the 2020 U.S. Census, some Florida Democratic lawmakers are hoping to see changes in the form. Ryan Daly reports those lawmakers are also calling for a question concerning citizenship to be scrubbed from the census form.
For far too many of our Native and non-Native people, this question will discourage them from participating in the census.
Democratic Senator Bobby Powell says a question on the upcoming 2020 census regarding the respondent's citizenship will cause many to not participate. Powell says he's concerned about the potential for a miscount.
As we await the Supreme Court's ruling on the constitutionality of including a question about citizenship on the census, I wish to share my opinion, my strong desire that this language be omitted from the questionnaire.
To push for an accurate 2020 count, Powell is pushing a bill that would create the Florida Complete Count Committee, made up of state and local government officials.
This committee would be responsible for coordinating available resources and developing outreach strategies to encourage full participation in the census process.
The proposed committee would include the majority and minority leaders of both state government chambers. It also calls for representatives from organizations like the State Association of Counties and District School Superintendents. Powell says outreach efforts would include a multilingual strategy and one geared toward reaching the elderly, as he says the process relies more heavily on computer and telephone inputs. Representative Susan Valdez says it's not just immigrants she worries may be impacted.
With current proposed changes to the census, communities of color, urban and rural low-income households, immigrants, and young children are all at risk of being missed by the census in the year 2020.
The Hillsborough County Democrat says that's significant because of funding dispersal guided by census data.
Federal agencies use the census data to allocate billions of dollars at the state and local levels for vital community services such as hospitals, fire departments, schools, roads, job training centers, senior centers, and police departments.
Senator Audrey Gibson used the example of public education dollars to illustrate how programs and grants are influenced by the census when it comes to funding.
Education, census data influences the distribution of billions of dollars, almost $16 billion, for Title I grants that help local educational agencies serve more than 24 million students in low-income families and communities. More than $12 billion for special education grants to states, along with funds for the National School Lunch Program.
And Gibson says census data has an impact on jobs in the state.
Company executives use census data to identify communities where they might build a factory or office building or open new stores. And new stores in our communities are extremely important.
Monday was 2020 Census Day, marking exactly 1 year until the coming census is conducted. Powell's bill is currently waiting to be heard by the Senate's Ethics and Elections Committee. I'm Ryan Daly.
Florida lawmakers want to educate students about human trafficking and child abuse. We get that story from Casey Chapter.
In 2018, Florida ranked third in the nation for reports of human trafficking, according to the National Human Trafficking Hotline. The recent discovery of a human trafficking ring in Central and South Florida has also prompted lawmakers and state leaders to revisit the issue. Here's Governor Ron DeSantis.
And I think we all know that Florida has been in some ways ground zero for human trafficking. And so I'm supportive of our Attorney General's efforts. I'm certainly open to looking at legislation that will be able to address it.
Attorney General Ashley Moody is chair of a statewide council on human trafficking. It works with law enforcement and legislators to combat the issue. Meanwhile, in the legislature, Representative Patricia Williams has a bill that would require K-12 schools' health classes to include lessons on the dangers and warning signs of human trafficking.
As a representative, as a citizen of the United States of Florida, as a parent, there's no cost amount that's too great for us to invest in our children. We're hoping that 259 will save lives. We're hoping that this will shine a light on the darkness that we have here.
The bill also draws attention to child abuse. Feli Curva, a lobbyist for the Society of Health and Physical Educators, says the issue is widespread among Florida schools.
It's been something that's been emanating, and a lot of our schools have been reporting as well. And it affects hundreds and thousands of students and children every year in the state of Florida. The proposed changes in this bill will help educate other subject area teachers as well as students at all grade levels across the state to recognize and respond not only to human trafficking but to child abuse situations as well.
Curva also cited 2018 data from the Department of Children and Families. It reports more than 130,000 children were involved with investigations for neglect or abuse last year. A similar bill in the Senate is scheduled for a committee hearing Tuesday. I'm Casey Chapter.
5 years ago, a new coral disease was found right off of downtown Miami. It's now spread through the Florida Reef Tract from Martin County down past Key West. WLRN's Nancy Klinginger reports scientists are taking unprecedented measures to make sure some coral survives, at least in captivity.
Biologists who study coral reefs spend a lot of time underwater, checking on the health of corals, watching the progress of coral bleaching and diseases, and hoping for recovery. But right now in the Florida Keys, Some biologists are taking chisels into the water to remove colonies of coral.
It hurts, yeah.
Nate Birkebile works for the State Fish and Wildlife Agency.
But it also feels good because now we know that we're trying to save the reef as much as we can.
Birkebile is on the front lines of the Coral Rescue Project. He's helping to collect thousands of individual coral colonies that are in the path of stony coral tissue loss disease and in danger of being wiped out. The disease affects the hard corals, like brain and star coral, literally the foundation of the reef. The reefs in Florida have been getting hit with diseases for decades. But Rob Ruzica says this disease, it's on a whole different level.
When the disease passes through an area, those species of corals, we're losing 95% of them.
Ruzica is a state biologist, one of the people in charge of the Coral Rescue Project. With such a high mortality rate, the scientists were watching the reefs disappear. And unlike with coral bleaching, there wasn't even a partial recovery.
It literally was equivalent to a forest fire.
The scientists started thinking about the rescue project last year after the disease jumped the gap between the middle and lower Keys. That's the span crossed by the 7 Mile Bridge. About a year ago, it showed up at one of the most iconic reefs in the Keys.
Once it reached Lou Key, it was a real turning point.
The scientists started talking about collecting the coral that was still healthy and doing it on a scale that's never been attempted before anywhere in the world.
It was really the only way to guarantee that there would be some survivors left.
They're having to move fast. Early this year, the disease reached the reefs off Key West, so they have to collect ahead of the disease line in areas like the Marquesas and the Tortugas. The corals will wind up at labs and aquariums around Florida and from New Jersey to Iowa to Texas.
And these are some leftover guys that were from the latest collection that we had.
But their first stop on land is here at the Keys Marine Lab on Long Key.
The Pseudodeporia strigosa is it's a type of brain coral.
And then I believe the Marine Lab is where Birkebile and Alan Anderson make sure the corals stay healthy.
So my position is actually titled coral caretaker.
That means feeding the coral, cleaning the tanks, and checking the water is clean and the right temperature. And also making sure they get along. Corals are animals.
Some species are way more high maintenance than others.
We're learning which corals are finicky. And in an aquarium, some corals, you know, they're just not good neighbors to one another. They will actually take their tentacle and actually slap the other individual.
Slapping isn't the only sign of a cranky coral. Some of them turn pale and lose their color when they're stressed out, like in coral bleaching. Besides making sure some corals survive the disease, the project's other aim is to breed them in captivity, so that eventually, if the disease burns out, the new baby corals can be transplanted to repopulate the reef. Ruzica says with all the challenges facing corals, a rescue plan to preserve a gene bank was overdue.
We are scientists, so we're used to measuring things, documenting how they're doing, but the actual removal process and then putting them into captivity and then driving these corals around the state of Florida is all very new to us.
Even though the project is focused now on collecting healthy corals while they can, they recently got a head start on the next step. Some of the rescued corals at the Florida Aquarium in Apollo Beach have already started to reproduce. I'm Nancy Klingener in Key West.
With the lawmaking session now heading into its second half, the urgency is building for lawmakers to start looking in their respective versions of the budget and address other outstanding issues, as we hear from Gina Jordan.
Here's what's happening tomorrow in the Florida legislature. A House committee will consider an initiative to develop, test, and implement sustainable technologies and approaches for controlling and mitigating the impacts of red tide. New requirements are being considered for law enforcement officers to obtain a warrant regarding the use of cell phones and similar devices. The bill focuses on location tracking and warrantless searches. In the Senate, a proposal would repeal laws allowing the use of red light cameras. Critics contend the cameras have become an excessive source of revenue for local governments, while supporters say they help improve traffic safety. Additional money may be headed to Northwest Florida school districts that lost enrollment because students were displaced by Hurricane Michael. A public records exemption may be created for information about 16 and 17-year-olds who pre-register to vote. Information would become publicly available when they turn 18. An environmental committee gets an update about the water war between Florida and Georgia. The legal battle involves the Apalachicola-Chattahoochee-Flint River system. Florida filed a lawsuit in the U.S. Supreme Court alleging that Georgia is using too much water from the system, damaging the Apalachicola River and Apalachicola Bay in northwest Florida. And the group Lauren's Kids is holding a 42 hours for 42 million advocacy walk this week using a treadmill inside the Capitol. State leaders will join Senator Lauren Book along with survivors and advocates in a 42-hour walk to honor more than 42 million survivors of child sexual abuse in the United States. That's some of what's happening tomorrow at the Capitol. I'm Gina Jordan.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, we started off this evening's show with a story connected to last October's Hurricane Michael. That piece dealt with the ongoing threat of wildfires aggravated by the millions of tons of drying timber on the ground. But there are other concerns as well. The storm played havoc with the number of students attending many of the institutions of higher learning located within the storm's sprawling footprint. Now, as Gabrielle Bolden tells us, state lawmakers might be able to boost enrollment by offering discounted tuition to out-of-state students.
The bill will allow institutions whose enrollment dropped by 10% or more after Hurricane Michael to waive out-of-state fees for students. Tallahassee Democratic Representative Ramon Alexander is sponsoring the bill. He says this gives the Panhandle an opportunity to increase the recruitment of students and assist the local economy.
When it comes down to those in the Panhandle that have been significantly impacted by Hurricane Michael, the economic impact of it, and giving folks the opportunity to come in and enroll at these particular institutions to sustain the enrollment and create viability on the campuses.
St. Petersburg Democratic Representative Wingate Newton says the devastation from the hurricane is unimaginable.
I don't even know how, if at all, when they will be able to maybe recover from that. So whatever we can do, whatever little bit, whatever large bit, whatever we can do to assist in them getting back to some state of normalcy is needed.
Gulf Coast State College had a 16% enrollment decline this spring, and the Chipola College Associate Degree Program enrollment decreased by about 30%. The college offers a differential tuition plan, allowing students in certain states to pay in-state tuition. Alexandra says that tuition plan will not interfere with the proposed bill.
The uniqueness is about the state of Florida is that we have a broad spectrum of campuses and communities and demographics, and I think it's incumbent upon those local communities and those local boards to make decisions in the best interest of their campuses and their colleges.
The Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee approved the bill unanimously. It has one more stop in the House but has not been heard in the Senate. I'm Gabrielle Bolden.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. Thanks also to Casey Chapter, Gabrielle Bolden, and Nancy Klinginger. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided tonight by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again every weeknight throughout the Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. HR Florida State Council. Advocating for the workplace on behalf of 15,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council. A resource for lawmakers, media, and human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. And from the United Faculty of Florida, representing over 20,000 faculty and graduate assistants at 13 universities and 14 colleges, working to encourage lawmakers to fund Florida's future through support of public education. Online at myuff.org.